So now it's my great pleasure to introduce, finally, our plenary speaker of the day. Dr. Kathy Pipas is our plenary speaker. She's an associate professor and vice chair of the Department of Community and Family Medicine at Dartmouth Medical School, where she's also an assistant dean of medical education, medical director of the Office of Community-Based Education and Research that supports over 300 community-based faculty members. And she is the director of the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Regional Primary Care Center, which is a collaborative of over 23 primary care practices. She's been a principal investigator on a number of HRSA grants. There's about that much more listing of accomplishments and activities that I'll skip over right now. But she's chaired the Society for Teachers of Family Medicine's pre-doctoral conference. She's been a member of the Education Committee. She's a founding faculty member of the Pre-Doctoral Directors Development Institute. In 2007, she received the Clinical Teacher of the Year Award at Dartmouth. And in 2009, she was inducted into the Gold Humanism in Medicine Honor Society. In her spare time, she's been working on an MPH, which she anticipates completing in June of 2011. Can a PhD be far behind? Who knows? It's a little wonder, given all the things that Dr. Pipas is doing, that her two daughters and husband are in a position where they have a nice cereal dinner. Cereal for dinner, okay? She doesn't have a lot of time to cook three-course meals. So, okay. So thank. Join me in thanking Dr. Pipas and welcoming her to the podium. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Thank you. Thank you. Good morning. I feel good being here already. I had the big decision of to run or not to run last night, and or to dance or not to dance. I chose to dance, and it was a great dance. So there was a few of you missing, and I understand the few of you that are missing have been nominated to chair next year's dance committee, Alec as the chief of that. And I chose not to run. I was happy about that decision this morning. My daughter called. It was minus 8 degrees, so I still need a little bit of time to thaw before I go home. It's going to be quite cold. But I've certainly taken a change in my pathway as an educator at Dartmouth, and this change has been directly influenced by mentoring medical students. The pathway has been bumpy at times, been extremely challenging at times, often less satisfying than I would have liked, and it's made me question at times, have I made an error in my pathway? But yesterday, Dr. Eva reassured me that if I have made an error, that it is to my advantage educationally. So I'm feeling good about that decision as well. I'm honored to be here. I'm honored to be here with so many of you that have mentored me. And before I begin the Dartmouth journey, I just want to spend a moment, particularly for students out there, to share my own pathway. And to show the richness of the opportunities and the experiences and the mentors that I've had along my family medicine pathway. So I'm from New Jersey originally, and I had the privilege of going to Jefferson Medical College, where a president was a family physician, and I thought that everybody had leaders around the nation that were family physicians. I got to work as a preceptorship in California, work with the World Health Organization, and travel to Thailand. And then I had the wonderful experience of working with Alec Chessman, Clive Brock, so many others in my residency in Charleston, South Carolina. Clive was from South Africa. I got to work in the time of the apartheid there. Got to do missionary work in Honduras. And then I began a little bit of a path north again. Did a fellowship in Chapel Hill, where the motto was curiosity without intimidation. And I worked with giants, met Kent Sheets, and so many mentors at that time. And then I took a little bit of a southwest lateral direction and again, worked with giants in family medicine. Joe Hobbs was the STFM president. Libby Poteet was there. Worked with Lanny Copeland, who was then the AAFP president. And again, continued to be mentored by strong family physicians. Since then, I've been at Dartmouth. And Dartmouth's a whole new world. Dartmouth's been a wonderful experience in many, many ways. I took on the role of associate residency director early on, and then after my second daughter was born, moved right into clerkship director and stayed for over a decade in leading medical school education, pre-doc directing, FMIG, mentoring, and leading our research preceptorships for students. And throughout the pathway, I've had the wonderful opportunity to work within the STFM organization and the Family Medicine Education Consortium and travel literally around the world. So I'm very grateful to all of you for where I am and what I've experienced. This is one of my favorite pictures. 2005, we had one of the matches of the year. We had 6 out of 10 students go into family medicine, greater than any other discipline at Dartmouth, and that was the exception. I mean, we began to see more and more of the rule. And we went from near 40-50% of students going into primary care to now where we're at about 20% of students going into primary care. And we lost a Pisacano scholarship recipient. Everybody know what that is? To surgery. And this was my best of the best FMIG leaders who, ironically, we actually funded his preceptorship with the surgeon who was a primary care do-it-all in rural Utah surgeon. But in talking to him, it became clear to me the reason he went into this was the reason he should have gone into family medicine. But he didn't feel that the systems that we had for care were those what he could add value to. And he didn't feel that the faculty, the role models that he had, were satisfied in the way he wanted to be satisfied in a career. And those two initiatives, in combination with an opportunity that I had from our chair in 2007 to begin to mentor faculty and begin to lead in a clinical arena and take on the role of section chief, are really why I chose a different pathway at that time. Two concerns I had as I began. One relates to the statement, if we build it, they will come. And one of the first challenges I saw were in leading the transformation into medical homes, our preceptors were saying, can you hold off on sending me a student? I'll take a placement maybe next block, because we're working on redesign. We're working on improvement. Can you just hold off? And so I challenged back that if we build it with them, they will be here. But if we build it without them, they may not come. And I have felt very strongly, it's really been a driving force for me, that students need to be there both to see what we're building and learn how to build themselves. Whether they go into orthopedic surgery or cardiology, they need to redesign skills, but they also need to be there to understand what primary care is about in order to want to be a primary care physician. My second concern was leaving all of you. I had a bias about clinical administrators, and I felt they were about numbers and volumes and dollars and RVUs, and I really didn't want to go there. And I learned that, yes, all my fears are very well founded. So I'm happy. I'm so happy to be back here with all of you today. But let me begin my journey. And this journey starts in 2008, and I'll show my objectives. It's fourfold. First, to set the stage for you, the background, what was happening with the national healthcare crisis, about cost, quality, and access, and how the medical home surfaced as a solution for all of us. And then secondly, to understand the value that we began to create in the systems, in the patients, and in the teams and learners from primary care, and how we leverage that value to get resources and to build infrastructure that we previously did not have. Thirdly, to share with you our strategic framework revolving around measurement, redesign, and finance. And lastly,
after identifying a few challenges, I'll show you how we're moving, what's our vision, and how we're going to get to our next steps to overcome some of those challenges. And as you can see, this is purposefully an uphill journey. This quote was about the same time we began our journey, and I'll just read it because it's so powerful to me. It rings true every day. The challenges we face are great, and we may not meet them in one term or with one president. But history tells us, as we have met greater challenges before, and the seriousness of the moment tells us we can't afford not to try. So as we set out on this journey, let us also forge a new path, a path that leads to unrivaled prosperity, to boundless opportunity, and to the America we believe in and a dream that will always endure. So here we are at the top. That's awesome. The United States, we're the black line. I have a pointer here. So we are on top of the world. And you know, before I started as an MPH student, I would have said, that's fantastic. We spend more, we must have more research, we've got more innovation, we've got more everything, more quality. And I became a student at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, the institute that Jack Weinberg founded. And I know he spoke here not long ago, and I began to understand his work. And his work revolves around healthcare cost and quality and the variation. And Jack's words are, more is not better. More spending is not better. And what more spending gets us? More hospitalizations, more specialty visits, and more procedures, but not more quality. So I know you're going to hear tomorrow morning much more about healthcare reform. So I've simplified all of what I've learned in 3 years at the Institute in my MPH into four bullets. So this is 3 years of an MPH at Dartmouth in a nutshell. So Jack Weinberg, more spending is not better. More supply is not better. And this is Dr. Dave Goodman, a pediatrician's work. And he says that we do not have a shortage of physicians. We have a shortage of physicians who go to physician shortage areas. It's a tongue twister. And when supplies go up, only family physicians go to these areas of low access. Elliot Fisher talks about the ACO and the patient-centered medical home, and Elliot's message now is so crisp that the patient-centered medical home cannot survive without an ACO, and the ACO cannot survive without the patient-centered medical home. And lastly, Dr. Paul Batalden. And again, he's the QI expert and the learner advocate, that we can't do these changes without changing the way we educate our future professionals. So I translate this all into three outcomes and four strategies. Three outcomes: we want high quality, we want appropriate utilization, and we want care for the whole population. And these become the focus of all of our metrics in the medical home, and I think they're right. I may be wrong, it may be an error, but I'll learn from it. But I think they're right. And the strategies we need to get there are, we need to transform the medical home. We need to transform all of us into patient-centered medical home. And this is where the bumps will come in. This will be hard. This will be hard work. But the medical home cannot survive unless we finance it. And we need to finance it so that we have the infrastructure so that we can build it properly. And we need to involve the learners in the process for the same two reasons. They need to learn how to lead and redesign no matter what field they go into. And we need to grow primary care physicians. So the medical home, I think, was a wake-up call for many of us. It's not about me as a provider. It's about me as a patient, but not as a provider. We love this slide back at home. And we have to show it to ourselves every once in a while. And the medical home evolution was occurring. It's quite a busy slide, but I'll tell you, despite its introduction in 67, it really started picking up momentum about the same time we were ready, 2007, with the joint principles being established, 2008 with the NCQA certification, and then 2009, many of the pilots began. And there's good literature, there's good evidence now that the medical home is the model we want. So how did we go about getting the infrastructure? How do we go about leveraging resources in a place that's not user-friendly for primary care? There's a few validators in the audience. Please feel free to stand up. Dartmouth has as many, if not potentially more, in some ways, challenges than all, but I think similar in a lot of ways. You know, our patients want access. They want to be known. They want good quality. The system is about dollars. The system is about money. The system is about generating referrals and volumes. We have employees that generate a lot of costs. We do not have a health plan. We are developing lots of contracts, and we want to meet those contracts, and we want to do whatever is out there to get those dollars. We're heavily governmental. We're about near 50% between Medicare and Medicaid, so we've taken quite a hit in that area. And we want to fund our research and education that may not be funded elsewhere currently. And our teams are, as other teams are, our teams are running on a fast pace and trying to keep up as educators and trying to do self-development, trying to be efficient and trying to keep growing and recruit and retain. The thing that has struck me the strongest about Dartmouth-Hitchcock since I've been there is the vision they adopted in 2007. I can say it in an elevator, I can remember it, and it has meaning to me. It is a valuable vision, the healthiest population possible, and it has guided all of our work. As you can see, we're about 30% primary care physicians, very similar to the nation. We have another 300-plus community-based faculty that we support. We have, we are growing into 90 students per year. We are increasing our class size significantly over the next 3 years, and we are, again, in size-wise, we have a electronic medical record. We're due for a big shakeup this April. We've been told no vacations. Go live date, April 2nd. And we have a portion of the CMS dollars that we've earned by savings and showing quality and demonstrating cost savings. So we've brought in about $10 million. And there we are, right about in the center of the state, covered in probably 4 feet of snow currently. The primary care system at Dartmouth, is about a third of the providers, many of which are not full-time clinicians. The Lebanon site is actually our academic site, Concord, Keene, Nashua, Manchester, our community sites, all of which prior to this project, prior to our initiation as a regional primary care center, really didn't have much to do with one another and really were not a collaborative. Serving over 300,000 patients across the region, but struggling with similar issues, but really not connected in any formal way. Our patients are a little bit healthier than the nation on average, but we still have the same issues when we study our patients, you know, same as causes of death in our country, heart disease, cancer, mental health, trauma. We have no motorcycle helmet laws in New Hampshire still. But we took our patients on the road, and I think this is probably the most powerful thing we did. I shared my patient. This is JP, a patient that I suspect all of you know. He's complex. He's diabetic. He's morbidly obese. He's on narcotics. He's depressed. He's been suicidal. He's got thrombocytopenia. He's got cirrhosis. He's got encephalopathy. You know him. And so we told our stories. You all know him. I saw this. We told our story based on the principles of the medical home. And, you know, I was pleased that our story had power, no matter who the audience was. But we said, JP deserves to get into our homes as easy as he gets into his banking, 24/7. JP deserves to have everything taken care of, all of his needs met in one place. JP needs to know and trust me, and he needs to know and trust my team. He needs to have quality care and an information system that supports his care, even when he's not face-to-face with us. He needs to know that we're coordinating when he goes to other visits and when he's in the hospital and he's in the ER. And we need to have a system that pays for this so that all of our time is available to do the right care for JP. And we need to have a system that pays for the time that's not just in the visit. And so focusing on a medical home focuses on the work that happens before the visit, after the visit, and the continuous work that continues despite time and place. We became Little David Lettermans, and we took our top 10 reasons to invest in primary care to the Board of Governors, to the Board of Directors, to any board that would listen to us. And we presented, again, healthcare is broken. We're the center. We are critical to improving costs and improving quality. We're essential to the vision of healthiest population possible. We are certainly essential to generating a referral base in the specialty access. That one spoke loudly. We are primed as a leadership group. The medical home is ready. It's endorsed. It's a recognized model. We can provide health, wellness, and savings across your employees. We have capabilities to do measurable improvement. We have 23 frontline teaching and research sites. And finance, this was probably the loudest for most of their ears, this future finance favors primary care, and we were beginning to see some of that, beginning to see pilots emerging. And it worked. And I still wonder, and I still sometimes question. But this is our team. We were endorsed in April 2008, Regional Primary Care Center, and to the right of me, our project coordinator, who is in the corner here, has joined me today, and I sent a couple notes to anybody who's in Dallas. She couldn't be better, and she's recently relocated to Dallas, so she drove down to be part of it. And I tell you, there's never been a team like this, and you appreciate team when you've got uphill battles, and I'm sure all of you have been there, when there's more challenges, more bumps. I have had more of an appreciation for team, vision, and a plan, and the strategic plan has to be tight, even tighter than HRSA wants. The I's have to be dotted, and the messages have to be clear. We have a new dean. Dean Chip Shuba has joined us, and if you look him up, he's got such amazing writings on leadership and strategic work. He is fabulous. So I'm learning, again, that Aaron pathway has taught me an enormous amount about leadership and strategic planning and the importance of that in moving forward. Yes, we have quite a complex organizational chart with the 300,000 patients in the middle. These are our 7 divisions, 23 teams. These are all the subcommittees, education, evaluation, measurement that support our work. And out here is our governance group, the medical directors of all of those divisions, reporting up to the Dartmouth-Hitchcock leadership. No slide. There we are. And we did get funding. We got, as part of the strategic plan in 2008, $1.5 million, most of which went to front lines, to our care coordinators and our patient data coordinators. This was a one-time thing, and I won't go into details, but our strategic plan was meant to be longer, but it lasted a year. We did continue to get that money, so none of these positions went away, but that was it. We really haven't gotten any additional funding in a project that we anticipated to continue to grow, so there's some growth stunt there. But we were able to, after our needs assessment, and I'll mention that in a moment with NCQA, we were able to identify gaps, and care coordination and patient data coordination were the gaps that we saw across our entire system. So the strategies that we took really evolved around a quality loop, and I've spoken to many of you here at the conference who are using PDSA cycles. It's very similar to all that. It begins with measurement. It begins with the needs assessment. It begins with balanced scorecards and tools that are user-friendly and performance review processes for everyone. And then prioritization. I think our challenge these days is so many different contracts, so many different people that want your metrics to be the top metrics. The prioritization in primary care is even more important. We can't do everything first. We can't do everything next. And so we really need to make some decisions because too much dilutes what we're trying to do. And then redesigning testing for us has really been about quality improvement for all and supporting our pilots. And dissemination and finance, I'll speak to you a little bit more about in the challenge section because we're still struggling with those two areas. But I'll begin with measurement and the needs assessment. And I had a wonderful first visit to the Practice Improvement Conference in December, and my team found it fabulous. So all of those who haven't been to the Practice Improvement and who are working on a medical home, I highly recommend it. We did a poster on the NCQA work we did, and we were highlighted because we have succeeded at having all 23 of our sites level 3 NCQA within about a year's time. And I certainly don't underestimate the work that occurred here. It was estimated that it was approximately 1,000 hours per application. And so people asked two questions at the conference, why and how? And the why is because it's a tool as a needs assessment. And I truly believe that. It provided the most guidance in what the medical home should be. Although the principles are clear, they don't go into any roadmap. And these 9 standards of care provide a roadmap and a needs assessment. We were able to do that and then do a gap analysis across all of our sites and identify. And again, care coordination, patient data coordination rose to the surface as priorities for us. But having a work plan after that for each medical home was critical. And this also provided the means for a work plan going forward so that each individual home would know what they needed and what they lacked. It certainly became the basis for our resource request, and it is now the basis for our compensation proposal, which I will update you on in a moment. The how, there's no question you need a champion at the site level. The site champion pulls all the data, pulls all the reports, and recreates the ones that you don't have. It's a learning experience for them, but there needs to be an on-site, fully dedicated person for the process time that you are applying for NCQA. And our champion, which is actually now a resident at UVM, was a medical student in a holding pattern who was looking for a position for a year and got trained and became an expert and really wound up being the collaborator and the network builder across our system so that our practices could learn from one another as they were completing this process. Additionally, we did some needs around learners in the medical home. In a pilot survey of 39 of our 145 ambulatory teaching practices, 9 of these were the actual medical home sites that I've spoken about. And we found that the majority of these take multiple learners, so either first, second, third years or residents as well as medical students. And similar to John Saltz and Patty Carney's article, we found about a little over half have EMRs, and the majority of the ones that have EMRs do provide access to our students. But concerning, we found only 25% of these were actually patient-centered medical homes. And again, this correlated with those 9 that had been part of this process. And of those, only 60% were orienting students to the medical home. And then we looked at what area students were actively participating in. And students were doing a lot of the traditional primary care work and participating in self-management, education, adding in some group visits, and beginning to do some huddles. But not as much quality improvement work as we had hoped, and certainly very little work with performance reviews, and then population management or registry data work was very much at the bottom. The barriers for learners participating in all of these activities were really the length of time that they were with them, as well as the continuity experience, and there was much more success. We did a similar for residents with involving residents. So we again began to prioritize our metrics once we've done our needs assessment, and I go back to the same metrics. These are categories now. We've got quality, utilization, population management, and quality. The grab bag is available. We have chosen things that were high cost. We frequently have done hypertension, diabetes, and then we have pediatric measurements as well, obesity, immunizations, and they rotate because when something's a priority, it moves, and then we don't want to marginalize something else in primary care. Utilization, we've been working on ambulatory sensitive admissions, readmissions, hospital, and emergency room. And population management for us has really been growth. It's been understanding panel size, risk adjustment, and then trying to understand the growth that we have. And that's been more challenging to get the data for. But RVUs are not part of our medical home scorecard. They are, however, still on, stand up and validate me, Leslie, Kathy, Dartmouth-Hitchcock scorecard. And we are still counted the beans on them, and we are still incentivized on them. And we are still compensated on them. So despite our work in aligning our metrics, we have not yet successfully aligned the institutional metrics, and we have not aligned the institutional compensation and incentive models. And that is quite a challenge. So I share this only to begin to highlight to you, and there's probably, I know Patty Carney's not here, but there's probably some data geeks that will appreciate the length of time it took to be able to develop reports and to be able to get the databases across these 5 divisions that previously weren't even talking to be able to create reports that were user-friendly. So this is one that I frequently use. This is divisional level benchmarking so that I can look across the different divisions and see where they are based on the stoplight, red, yellow, or green. There's practice level equivalents of these in scorecards. We also have disease-specific scorecards, so we can look across diabetes and then across divisions or sites. And then we have provider-specific. And this is the one that we like the most and we like the least. None of us like to be yellow or red, but it's probably the most powerful. And I show a resident one as an example because the learners are involved in this. And we have, unfortunately, struggled with getting students involved because of the lack of a concept of having a population that they cover. But we, again, encourage students to be part of the process of review, even though it's not their numbers. But yes, I am potently activated when I see my numbers and I am not in the green. Maybe it's the Hawthorne effect, maybe it's the competition, but it's valuable. And so redesign for us is really about creating a culture of performance improvement. We've gone to team-based care, and that's including our students, and getting our students to not be rotating with 10, 15 different preceptors in a practice, but get them focused on a team that has specific team goals, that has specific team priorities, and that has team plans, as well as performance reviews. And all of our reviews are shared by everyone. These are transparent. They're on the wall. Patients can see them. So the idea of reviewing performance is a regular weekly, monthly, and an annually process for all of us. The collaborative training has been one of the most exciting things, getting people at conferences like this away from the practice. And when we do it in teams. So we're bringing all of our teams and myself, my nurse, my secretary, and we rotate teams. The whole practice obviously can't go at one time, but they've been very powerful ways of building change within the practice. Some of the most exciting work has been around these new roles. Before the medical home, many of these roles didn't exist. And so defining the roles and maximizing the roles, we now can say we have care coordinators in 100% of our practices. We have patient data coordinators in 100%. We have patient family advisors. These didn't cost us anything. They were volunteers. We have learners. No one got off the hook. And we have a new program called the QIPS, Quality Improvement Pros, that I'll spend a moment on as well in a minute. And the job descriptions are what have been the key piece of understanding this. What can everyone do to optimize their roles? And some physicians have been uncomfortable with this for two reasons. They've been uncomfortable thinking, oh, this is really about someone else doing my job and I'm not pulling my weight. And the flip side has been, this is about letting someone else do something that I don't trust they can do. And so I say the physicians are probably the most challenging in getting everyone to function at the highest license ability so that we can be as most efficient as possible. Population management tools have been critical, user-friendly tools, registries, summary reports, evidence guidelines, care plans. It's really been about building tools and about supporting pilots. And we've supported pilots that have been disease-focused. We've really let the teams decide this, and this is where a lot of our support is at the front line. We have employee health pilots. Hopefully you got to see the shared decision-making, which was a learner pilot. We also have shared decision-making in faculty practice pilots, geriatrics medical home, also a HRSA-funded pilot, behavioral health and health coaching that are going on throughout the region. And then that focus on that continuous care, pre, post, and visit-based care in a continuous fashion. So improvement starts with me, and this has really been such an exciting area. I've begun reflecting and journaling. Last year I had a personal improvement project. I did it 45 times in the year, journaled at night. And this year I'm actually up to 22. And it's only the 22nd, so I'm improving. I love Socrates, an unexamined life is not worth living. But we do these individually. We do them with our teams. We've been doing them with our senior leaders, but doing SWOTs. And if you're not familiar with a SWOT, it's a wonderful improvement tool to understand your strengths, your weaknesses, your opportunities and threats, and then to maximize their strengths and opportunities and minimize the weaknesses and threats. We hear this all the time. Can't change. Mostly time was the highlighted reason for not wanting to change. But we went back for resources and found none. And so as much as we wanted to bring in the experts and bring in the consultants to help change every practice, there was no resources. Despite hearing the no, we don't want to change, when we offered a quality improvement training program, we got an enormous number of volunteers. We had hoped to have at least one per practice, so we were hoping for 23. We got 40 participants. And again, this was based on the premise that the people who do the work are the best qualified, and everyone has the capacity to learn improvement tools. So our participants varied. We didn't know what would be the best participant, and so all comers were welcome. And I tell you, one of my disappointments is that this other does not include a single medical student because of the schedule, because of the lack of continuity in the time that they were with us. But other than that, we had all members of our team, secretaries, nurses, patient data coordinators, all have volunteered to be QIPs. I was hoping to actually be a participant, but I wound up being a faculty member. We have a collaborative learning model, and it's all about building quality improvement in the medical home. We did 3 one-day workshops. All the participants set personal learning goals and had quality improvement applications right at their frontline sites. Evaluation was self-assessment, site-specific assessment, and then we monitored patient outcomes, particularly of the pilot teams that the QIPs were working with. The curriculum was this alphabet soup of different types of quality improvement skills. I lose my clicker here. Okay. The tools, many of which I'd never seen before, but PDSA, the fishbone, the plan, do, study, act cycles, multiple different sets of tools that were used. This was one of my favorites, flow mapping, and this was something that we had done at many of the retreats. We'd each get a different color sticky, so if you were a doc, you had a blue sticky, a nurse, you had a yellow pad of stickies, and if you were a care coordinator, you had orange, secretary, you'd have pink, and the board was the wall. And we would map out a flow process. We would map out the current flow process, and we would map out the future flow process. And you couldn't touch anyone else's stickies in the current. But in the future, you could take someone's pink and move it over here and say, I want you to do this, and I think you should be the one to do that, and I'd like to do this, and I don't want to do this anymore. And so that process was extremely valuable in figuring out what we're doing and trying to identify an optimal state of what we should be doing. The QIPs each chose areas to work in, and the last column is the one we've studied the most to understand those that have looked and we believe those that felt most comfortable already with your leadership skills and your knowledge and use of the tools began to say, I'm going to work on specific pilots to improve the care. And most of those were focused on hypertension, which was our 2010 adult priority. They did self-assessments, and certainly they're reporting themselves to be more competent in using quality improvement tools after the training, as well as willingness to use them. And those who weren't willing to use reported it as being time. I mentioned the only criteria for being a QIP was that your medical director had to authorize you, endorse you, and give you the time to attend, as well as the time on site to participate in the projects. And I just want to highlight here the hypertension numbers. The definition of our hypertension metric this year was percent of patients below 140 over 90. As a system, our average was 68 in 2009. In 2010, our average went up to 73, but we had some significant improvements in pilots. And when we look at the division level, data can be misleading. This looks like we're all pretty darn flat. These are the different divisions. But when we get to an actual team, so this is the Manchester division, the iMed practice, and Team C has had significant improvement. And again, this allows us to try and get to the next level of how do we take these pockets of success and move to system-wide success. And so these are our current 3 challenges. How do we disseminate the pockets of success, assuring system-wide success? How do we align old compensation and incentive models with new medical home performance metrics, despite our lagging payment reform? We still have about 99% of our payment in a fee-for-service world. And how do we align the medical student's curriculum to maximize the student's role so that they're in the medical home to assure that they will be here? And lastly, I'll just share my vision and next steps and how we try and overcome that. My daughter's helped with this slide, as you can notice, the text language. I said, are you sure that's how you spell R? What does the end state look like? And how will we know when we're there? They participated in the sense of they're always asking, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we done? How will you know as a parent when things are done? And I don't have the answer for this question, but I do believe in our vision. I believe we're looking for the healthiest population possible. And I do believe in our metrics. And so I have to answer this question with that. If I believe in our vision and I believe in our metrics, our outcome is achieved when we have system-wide success in quality, cost utilization, and population management. And so our next steps are really overcoming the barriers that seem to be preventing us from getting there. Firstly, aligning to achieve best practice system-wide. And we tried a fishbone exercise. Again, I love this one. This is Tanu's slide here. The outcome we want is best practice targets to be met system-wide. And so this is the outcome. And we start to look, what are all the drivers? What are all the ways we can get there? And this was done in a brainstorming leadership meeting, best practice summit. This is something where we're now bringing together those that achieved it, those that had best performing practices, and diving deep into what they're doing and forcing them to understand what they're doing, and then creating toolkits that will be at some point web-based. A lot of our web-based materials are in development. Simulation training so that everybody can be competent in what we determine to be best practice. Communication, again, creating these web-based, going from what we have now at intranet at Dartmouth to internets. And then this will probably be our next largest challenging. So I believe that we can cut and paste to a degree. We can take what's working in one practice and move it to another practice to a degree. But we've got to begin to understand what many people are now describing as the complex adaptive system and teamness. It's not going to work totally to understand what happens in one team and to believe it will happen in another team. We are all too different in terms of our interrelated relationships. And so we realize that will be another barrier. But we're committed to, again, evaluating and studying these programs. In terms of aligning metrics and compensation, I ask our senior leadership a basic question, and you know, they don't like me now. I ask them, and I like to be liked, so it's been a little uncomfortable, but do you want me to be accountable for 5,000 visits? Or do you want me to be accountable for the health of 5,000 patients? Because I will act very differently, and my team will act very differently, and my metrics will be very different. And they can't answer it because they're not prepared. And I'm trusting, and I tell them I trust that I believe Dartmouth does want to leap ahead and be one of the first that's not a health plan to be able to take that jump despite our lagging healthcare reform and begin to pay us in different ways that we can be accountable to the behaviors that we really want. And so our compensation proposal, which I'm embarrassed to say has been on the table for nearly 2 years, is very simple. It's recognition for all of the pieces of the NCQA at different levels. And I don't even have dollars here because as much as people come together for patients and they come together for students, they don't come together around dollars. So we keep it generic. We keep it high-level principles. It's a pay-for-performance bonus, and we are getting some of those at Dartmouth for different pilots, but to share those at primary care. And a utilization bonus, again, when cost is saved. And I appreciate now, with my new economic education, that when savings occur, and we have in one of our pilot sites had a 67% reduction in readmissions, hospitalizations, and a 20-some percent reduction in ER. And we know that means decreased revenue. We're not saving the money right now. So we're not expecting that pool of money to be shared with us. But at some point, if an ACO identifies that pool of money from a payer and shares that, we do expect to be part of that savings so that we can grow our programs and grow our practices. And the population base is considered a raise. And this is revenue that we know will expand downstream into the whole institution and the system. So this is a work in progress. And lastly, the importance of our QIP program and aligning it with DMS. And I'm committed to making this alignment occur. I'm committed to having the three sciences that Dartmouth now waves their arms around the importance of the basic science, the clinical science, and the science of healthcare delivery. We are the best place for students to learn that. But we have to shake up our curriculum so strong. We can't do it if 2 years are basic science and 1 year is clinical science, and then we throw an elective and maybe a couple hours here and there to do healthcare delivery science, or expect students to jump onto quality improvement projects or be part of a team for 7 hours or 7 weeks. We need a major shakeup in our curriculum if we're really going to allow students to be part of a redesign science that connects to basic science and clinical science. And this is where my call to all of you is. The call is that we've got to be strong, that they need to be part of the medical home. Someone else may be building the medical home, but don't let your medical students not be part of that process. They need to be there, and they need to have changes so that their time, their continuity, and their relationships are built. I'll summarize with my Pipus pearls here. Yes, the healthcare crisis exists, but it is our opportunity for primary care. The stars are aligned like I haven't seen them aligned prior. We need to leverage the value that we provide to build infrastructure, to get resources. The importance of a vision, a plan, and the right people are so important. Transformation starts with metrics, and we've got to know our baselines. NCQA is our friend. We've got to redesign at the front line, support our pilots, find our high performers, and then take the time to get everyone trained in quality improvement skills. System-wide success is much more than duplication, and this will be where we head into the future, understanding relationships among ourselves, not just with our patients, but among our teams. Finance has to follow metrics. We will never come to fruition if finance doesn't follow metrics in the medical home. And lastly, the medical home is and can be the ideal place to align healthcare redesign in medical education and to grow our future primary care workforce. So what have I learned? I've learned to listen. I've learned to exercise, for example, or anything else I can do, for example. I've learned to ask, starting to get much better questions. And I've learned the basics. Don't forget, please, and thank you. And thank you very much. There's a few resources there, and I'm happy to post these slides for anyone who has questions.
Kathy Biltoffer from Portland, thanks very much for a stimulating talk. And I'm worn out just listening to all the changes that have gone on in Dartmouth. Can you tell us who have been your allies in the academic center and who have been more challenging and how we can learn from that?
Do you want names? I can give you names. Our allies, I'll be perfectly frank, are the pediatricians and the internists. I probably say primary care more than I say family medicine, and 5 years ago I never thought that would be the case. But we are one and we are unified, and we are a power that's not to be reckoned with. We have specialists that understand us more than we ever believed, but we have senior leadership that doesn't get it. And they don't get it. They get it in theory. They get it in the high-level vision. But when it comes to strategy and operation, they're very happy for RVUs to still be a metric and to not feel that that is a conflict with every bone that we're making. Every ounce of our energy conflicts with visit-based care still. And so our strength is our patients, our strength are our students, our strength is our primary care colleagues, and we still need to continue to be David Lettermans, if you will, out there with senior leaders who operationally are disconnected.
How would you integrate medical students bringing value into a primary or patient-centered medical home with medical student education?
Well, I actually saw a poster here that probably has had better success in outcomes than we have. I want to say it was poster number 17, Middlesex. Anybody here owning that poster? All right. So this is the woman that you want to ask, because they not only looked at students involved in quality improvement projects, but they looked at patient outcomes, and they trained students to be quality improvement experts, similar to what we're proposing, and they engage students in doing their own needs assessment, following a population of patients. They did it around depression and maternal health around one of the projects that the FMEC has supported and had some evidence for. And they showed enormous outcome improvement for their preterm labor. And so, again, they call it a win-win. And we've had win-wins like that, but we've not been able to track the students' projects directly to patient outcomes the way we all hope to do. So I think the importance is getting the students involved in needs assessment, letting them ask the questions and find the data and come up with the solutions, find the literature to support what they want to do, and then be there and let them be part of the process of our improvement teams. Let them review their data and see what's happening and see the effects of their work with us, and make sure that they can come out of this. And we've had this conversation yesterday. They can come out of this seeing that they can make a difference in the medical home the same way that we can now make a difference for patients in the medical home, because that, I believe, is what's going to reverse losing our future Pisacano scholars.
Well, Kathy, thank you for a very stimulating data. Thank you for leading the way. That is an excellent talk. Couple question. You know, there are all these wonderful things we can do with our learners, and I definitely think we need to bring our medical students along. But we all know that the third year is just so long, and there's just fierce fights about who owns what and who needs what. And we at Penn State has been going through a very, I think, a very innovative curriculum we designed in the third year, only to be brought down by the role chairs who felt that they must get their four-week elective in their third year, and the whole process is put on hold. So I wonder if you have any strategy or recommendation as to how do you bridge that divide? How do you bring everybody together to say, yes, we need role specialists, but we need primary care physician, and it has to happen in the third year. So I want to hear about that. And the other thing is, we also have known that we are all excited about the patient-centered medical home, but a lot of the student, actually a lot of our faculty, don't know what it is, and I'm not sure they necessarily care what it is. Do you have any strategy to try to bring that message across? How do you inspire those people and inspire the student, particularly, say, this is really for your own good. This is really important for your education. Thank you.
Well, my short answer is communication and leadership. My longer answer is, you know, the patient-centered medical home has caught on for some outside of primary care as a term. For others, it hasn't. And you know, I think in general, the momentum is strong. The principles behind it are probably more important than the name, although if the name works, hey, we're happy to have the name move things for us. But the principles of redesign have spoken across all of our disciplines at Dartmouth, and the redesign is working and speaking in OBGYN, and the redesign is working in orthopedics, and the redesign language and the missions are happening across systems. And I guess my hope is that medical schools that have senior leaders that believe redesign is an important part, and this was part of UME 21 a while ago, that quality improvement had to be taught to medical students, but now it has to be taught in a much more intensive, hands-on, get in the laboratory and learn it way, that those deans will be able to convince all disciplines that we have to do this and we have to do it together. And we're not going to have, hopefully we're not going to have duplication where we have, you know, six different didactics about this, but we have the core didactics, which are generic, and then we have all of the clerkships working together in a way to say, what can you provide in your laboratories for students to have opportunities to apply these quality improvement skills? And whether that happens in family medicine or whether that happens in cardiology is probably less important. But what's important is that they know, and I can speak for Dartmouth, is that the majority of it is happening in primary care. And so that's, if you were to just be generic and go with the, well, let's see where it can happen, my sense is that it would turn around back on us and say, you know what, the majority of change is happening in these practices. This is where they have teams working on redesign. That's where we want to send our students. Would be my hope. I'll think some more on it. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Leslie Fall. I'm a colleague of Kathy's at Dartmouth. First, a comment. What you guys have seen here is true.
Thank you.
Both the positives and the negatives. Kathy's correct, and then our leadership is still working to understand it. But also, the degree of work that she's presented today is completely valid. It's been an impressive amount of work over the course of the last couple of years. Kathy and I were clerkship directors. I'm a pediatrician. And it's been unfortunate that we've had to break up our educational collaborative to build patient-centered medical homes and FM cases. But that being said, not only is this, Kathy's correct, and it's been impressive to watch the pediatricians, internists, and family physicians come together to be a force to be reckoned with, to the extent that I really have not seen happen at Dartmouth previously. The part Kathy won't tell you is that not only are those three groups together a force to be reckoned with, actually, Kathy is a force to be reckoned with. So I've been, to some extent, okay with losing her as a colleague educationally to watch what's been happening in primary care at Dartmouth. So Kathy, thank you from all of us for the work that you've done and for presenting it incredibly eloquently today. The work that you see up here is truly all the work she's done. The question I have is, in your patient-centered medical home slide at the very beginning, you talked about really what that looks like for JP. I think the question that we all struggle with, and that I know our students struggle with, is what is JP's role in that patient-centered medical home? And what is the role of this incredible system that we're creating for JP, and yet really the only one who's going to get his blood pressure under 140 over 90 is JP himself. You talk about our employee health program, and it's impressive. I've watched it roll out over the last year, and yet you look at our employees when we check in to be patients ourselves and look at our employees and go, ooh, there's a lot of work to happen there. And I know our medical students are frustrated by that, and our residents are frustrated by the fact that the system is hard enough to change. How do I change my patient? Can you comment a little bit on the role of the patient in your system?
Absolutely. And I thank you for your comments, Leslie, because at home we don't get the praise, and sometimes the hurdles are more than we want to handle. And I also want to thank the person that did step into my role, who has really made the educational program at Dartmouth such a wonderful success. And without Kathy Morrow, I probably would not have felt comfortable taking that detour on my path. The particular patient, JP, is not activated at all. JP is actually quite unmotivated to do any of his care, but I think he's the exception. I think that the medical home is committed, and it is part of our role to find opportunities for patients to be as activated as possible, and that is electronic ways. The care plan is one of the tools that I've seen to be the most activating for a patient, because they own it. It's their care plan, and they can carry it around with them. They can have it electronically. They can take it from provider to provider or to wherever they're going, and they create it. And so having access, we have a couple of different software programs that we're toying with for this new medical record that's coming out. But there are many, many, many patients out there that want to be much more active in their own healthcare, and we have got to identify roles for them to get into their healthcare system, again, visit-based or not visit-based. Most of their opportunities can be non-visit-based, and whether it's a phone call from our care coordinators to see how their weights are, or they're recording it on a journal and emailing it back in and getting on log sites and monitoring their own blood pressures, it's a critical piece, and the patient family advisors in our system have actually been the voice to help us activate and identify areas that we know patients can and will be interested in partnering with us in the medical home. So it's a critical thing. I think we can continue to communicate more and more with patients about what the medical home is. There's been kind of two camps. One is, let's just do it better. We don't have to call anything different. Let's just give them the right care. And others are saying, it's been broken for so long, we have to name it something else. And name it something else and then do that different work that's really so much more optimal. So I as a patient myself, I'm always looking for ways to be more engaged in our own care and fully support those.